Third of all, the crown was transferring the right of nominating the bishops from the cathedral chapters to itself. And this tended to affront local privilege. It had been a long tradition that the cathedral chapters have the right to nominate the bishops. The crown was now taking this out of their hands. And finally, the simple act of redrawing boundaries, even if in the interest of efficiency or greater operational power, affronted tradition. As the historian Peter Guile has said, altogether it was a very great measure. Its bold logic and symmetry and its vigorous attack on historic development and ancient rights were thoroughly characteristic of the spirit of the monarchy and its rationalistic lawyer servants. And for all of those reasons, the aristocracy didn't like it. Opposition to the new bishopric scheme was organized by the members of the high aristocracy, this group called the Grandees. And especially prominent among these were three aristocrats. First of all, the Count of Egmont, who was the provincial governor of Flanders and Artois. Second of all, Philippe de Montmorency, who was the Count Hornus. And third of all, William of Nassau, the Prince of Orange, and also the provincial governor of Holland, Zeeland, and Utrecht. Orange was an extremely wealthy man. Indeed, his annual income seems to have been almost the same as that of the central governments. And the grandees among them also commanded the heavy cavalry troops called the Bande d'Ordonnance. So these are men who are not only rich and powerful, they also have military clout as well. The grandees' opposition to the new bishopric scheme focused in particular on Cardinal Granvelle, because he was the chief minister to the crown, and it was pretty clear that he was going to be nominated as the Archbishop of Mechelen. So he was going to be placed at the top of this new scheme of reorganizing the bishoprics. He symbolized, in a sense, in his own person he came to symbolize, the affronts of the crown to all of the particular sympathies of the grandees. And therefore, Hornus, Egmont, and the Prince of Orange formed a solemn league against Granvelle, and in March of 1563, they bluntly informed Philip II that unless Granvelle were dismissed from state office, they would resign from the Council of State. This ultimatum was actually deliberately timed at a moment of crisis for Philip's monarchy. A freak storm had destroyed 25 Spanish galleys off the Andalusian coast in the previous fall. And in April of 1563, Algerian pirates had taken advantage of this naval disaster to lay siege to the Spanish fortress of Oran in what is now Algeria. Philip resisted the ultimatum made by the grandees to get rid of Cardinal Granvelle, but the members of the Solemn League, as they called themselves, began boycotting all the meetings of the Council of State. And the provincial states of Brabant, seeing what was going on, got in on the act as well, and they declared that they were going to withhold all the taxes until Granvelle left. Again, Philip II was forced to capitulate. There was an effort to put a fig leaf over what was going on. Granvelle was told that it had, after all, been a very long time since he had visited his old mother in Burgundy, and it might be a good idea for him now to see her. But it was clear what was going on. And on the 13th of March, 1564, Cardinal Granvelle rode out of Brussels for Burgundy, and he never came back again. The third source of conflict between the crown and what we might want to call the political nation of the Netherlands was a kind of intensification and transformation of the heresy problem. As I had mentioned earlier, up until the early 1550s, there hadn't really been that many heretics, at least from a Catholic perspective, in the Habsburg Netherlands. And moreover, those who had been prosecuted for heresy tended to be Anabaptists, who, because of the fact that they were socially marginalized and, second of all, seen as a kind of a threat to all of society, meant that their prosecutions didn't bother as many people. But what happened from the late 1550s, and especially the early 1560s, was that Calvinist communities began to grow in numbers in the Netherlands. Indeed, the number of places where we can document Calvinist congregations in the Netherlands increased by something like 10 times between 1561 and 1566. Now, we're of course confronted with the natural question, why? Where are all these Calvinists coming from? Some of the reasons we've reviewed in our discussion of the wars of religion in France, and there might have been an inherent appeal of Calvinist doctrine, Calvin's doctrine, the discipline of a Calvinist lifestyle to many people. But second of all, it should be stressed that the French wars of religion, which broke out in 1562, created an awful lot of Calvinist refugees, and a lot of them migrated to the Netherlands, where they thought they could seek shelter. Third of all, and this is not trivial, Calvinism was a much more socially respectable kind of religion. And for that reason, it tended to draw a sort of protective sympathy among the ranks of the burghers in the cities and the aristocracy as well. It is true, and it probably should be stressed, that Calvinists remain a really tiny minority among the population as a whole in the early 1560s. But again, as we've seen in other contexts, perception often mattered more than reality. As far as the authorities were concerned, the rise of Calvinist congregations represented a kind of heretical tidal wave. And therefore, from the 1560s, and actually already from the late 1550s, prosecutions and executions for heresy increased dramatically in the Habsburg Netherlands. Between 1550 and 1566, some 1,600 cases of heresy were tried in the province of Flanders alone. Nevertheless, the anti-heresy campaign was a failure in a double sense. In the first place, it did not stem the tide of Calvinism. Calvinist congregations continued to grow despite the persecution.